Gospel according to St. Matthew. Jesus got into a boat and his disciples followed him. Suddenly, a violent storm came upon the sea, so that the boat was being swamped by waves. But Jesus was asleep. They came and woke him, saying, "Lord, save us. We are perishing." He said to them, "Why are you terrified, O you of little faith?" Then he got up, rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was great calm. The men were amazed and said, "What sort of man is this whom even the winds and the sea obey?" Thus were the words of today's Holy Gospel. We've begun the month of November, the last month in the church's liturgical year, which we concentrate with greater focus on the four last things: death, judgment, heaven, and hell, and look at our day-to-day journey with the end of our earthly pilgrimage in mind. The month begins with celebrating the Solemnity of All Saints, which reminds us all of the fact that God has created us for no other purpose than to become holy as He is holy. The day after All Saints, we commemorate our faithful departed, praying that all the dead may be admitted into the company of the saints, and remembering that we too are dust, and unto dust we shall return. The entire month is a privileged occasion for us to focus more deeply on what we should be pondering throughout the year, in fact, every day, that our life has meaning, that our existence in this world will not last forever and isn't all that there is, and that real wisdom lies in keeping this end of human life in mind, so that we not only will not get distracted or lost along the journey, but so that we can order our steps in the direction of the heavenly Jerusalem rather than eternal self-alienation from God. Today's readings help us to contemplate two things we must confront as we ponder the last thing. The first is our existential fear of suffering, death, judgment, and what comes after. Fears that the evil one never ceases to foment. The second regards the way we need to live this life so that we might live forever. Let's take each of them in turn. Today's gospel about Jesus' calming of the winds and the seas is much more than a demonstration of the Lord's power over the forces of nature. He who with a word created the heavens and the earth, the seas and all they contain, with a word could calm them. And as we see in the gospel, he did. Neither is today's passage from St. Matthew a manifestation of the failure of the apostles to believe in this power of Jesus. They knew that he had the power to calm the seas, which is why they woke him in the first place. They had, after all, already seen him by this point cast out demons, cure Simon Peter's mother-in-law and those who were ill, heal lepers, forgive the sin and paralysis of a crippled man, and straighten the withered hand of another. They had no doubts about Jesus' power. The point of today's gospel is that even though they knew he had the power to calm the seas and the wind, they began to doubt whether he would use that power for them. The gospel is a display of their failure to believe in Jesus' love for them. St. Mark's version of the same scene, as they startled Jesus from what must have been a very deep and long overdue sleep on an uncomfortable and rocky boat, they asked, "Master, do you not care that we are perishing?" Do you not care? They'd begun to doubt whether Jesus gave a hoot whether they drowned in the lake. They'd begun to question whether he was indifferent to their plight, whether he had no concern at all whether they died. Jesus' whole life, of course, is an answer to that question. He did care that we too were about to die, and die forever. And that's the reason why the Son of God, the second person of the Blessed Trinity, took our human nature and was born of the Blessed Virgin. He cared enough that he spent himself to the point of exhaustion, teaching, healing the sick, and comforting the afflicted. He cared so much that he ultimately took our place on death row, giving his life so that we might survive. Like Jonah, who was tossed into the sea in order to calm the ferocious storm, so Jesus tossed himself overboard to quell the tempests that were causing us to die. As he hurled himself into the abyss from the cross, he calmed the storm of sin so that we might reach the eternal shore. His entire life was a demonstration of the depth of his loving care. The problem was the apostles doubted that saving concern. Just like the serpent in the desert had seduced Eve and Adam to doubt in God's love for them, so here again he was tempting the apostles. In this, the 12 were like the 12 tribes of Israel 1,300 years before. After they had witnessed God's hand in the 10 plagues of Egypt, after they had seen him part the Red Sea, after they had witnessed Pharaoh's horsemen and chariots perish, after they had seen Moses strike the rock to provide them with water, after they had been fed miraculously with manna and then quails from heaven, after they had seen the thunder and lightning of Moses' conversations with God on the top of Mount Sinai, after all of this, the Israelites continued to doubt God's love for them. They obviously knew that God had the power. They'd already seen so many demonstrations of that strength. But they didn't have faith that he would continue to use that power for them. Was it because there were no graves in Egypt, they complained to Moses, that you have taken us away to die in the desert? Whenever anything got difficult, they grumbled. They doubted. They began to question whether God's solicitude had an expiration date. His past actions, all of those demonstrations of love, didn't factor into their moral equation. The same thing was happening with their descendants in the boat on the Sea of Galilee. They had witnessed Jesus' power and his goodness on so many occasions, but they began to wonder whether his love, not his power, had a limit. They began to question whether he was indifferent to their plight. It was, to put it simply, a lack of faith in who he was, based on a failure to grasp the meaning of all he had done up until then. That's why Jesus, as soon as he had awakened, turned to his followers and said, "Why are you terrified, you of little faith?" The same lack of faith that happened to Adam and Eve in the garden, to the Jews in the desert, and to the apostles in the Sea of Galilee can happen to each and all of us. Generally, few of us question whether God has the power to work a miracle. But very often we begin to wonder whether he has the will. When we're assailed by the storms of sorrow, the downpours of doubt, the twisters of uncertainty, the hail of anxiety, and the blizzards that leave us feeling so alone and cut off, we can start to imagine that he's having sweet dreams while we're experiencing nightmares. We can start to reckon that he's snoring when we're screaming for help. And when these doubts begin to grow with regard to our day-to-day situation, how much more can they assail us when it comes to suffering at the end of life, to death and beyond? The cancer of doubting the Lord's love for us happens when we, like the 12, begin to forget all that the Lord has done for us up until now, and what that reveals about who he is and how much he loves us. As St. Paul wrote to the Romans, if God didn't even spare his own son but handed him over for us all, will he not give us everything else besides? If God the Father was willing to allow his son to be brutally murdered so that we might live, he's going to respond with love in every circumstance by giving what he knows we need. But we have to have faith in him and in the power of this love. The apostles were anxious in the boat because they were paying more attention to the waves and to the winds around them than to the presence of Jesus with them. The same thing happens with us. Today's scene is a reminder of the need to focus more on Christ than on our problems. This is the mark of a life of faith. Jesus turns to you and to me in the midst of whatever hardships we are experiencing, and with regard to our most basic human fears, and says, "Why are you terrified, O you of little faith?" To believe in Jesus means not just to trust in his power. It means to have faith in his goodness and love, and that goodness and love will last forever. So if we're terrified about the various storms of our life, whether we will suffer, for example, at the end of our life, the loss of our memory through Alzheimer's, or muscle control with ALS, or to have to endure excruciating physical agony, the types of fears that the agents of death try to exploit to push physician-assisted suicide and other types of evils. Jesus wants to strengthen us to have no doubt about his presence. Just like he permitted the apostles to endure the ferocious tempest on the Sea of Galilee to strengthen them in faith, so sometimes he allows us to experience great difficulty, so that we can grow in faith precisely through confronting our fears together with him. Jesus has a one-track mind. He wants us to live forever with him. And if what that takes to help us to have the faith to respond and open ourselves to his love is to put us out in the middle of an ocean fearing for our life, he'll do it. He's not an indulgent parent or a grandmother who might just give us something that we want simply because we want it. He's a strong father who'll give us what we need. Sometimes we need suffering in order to trust in him more. Sometimes we need the cross, and a very difficult cross, not one made out of styrofoam with velvet on the outside with wheels on the bottom, but a heavy, crushing cross, in order for us to be crucified to the world so that we might live truly in relationship with him. And if he knows we need that, he loves us so much to give it to us even when we're crying to escape from it. That's the type of faith that the month of November is given to us to help bring about. But faith alone is not enough. As St. James reminds us, faith without works is dead. A living faith, St. Paul tells us, overflows through works of love. And that's what today's epistle from St. Paul's letter to the Romans helps us to remember, which is a key as we seek to live in such a way that as we approach death and judgment, we will not be eaten alive by fear. St. John of the Cross wrote, "In the twilight of life, God will judge us not on our earthly possessions or human successes, but on how well we have loved." To love God with all our mind, heart, soul, and strength, and to love our neighbor as Christ has loved us, is the synthesis of holiness. It is the way that will lead us to eternal happiness at Jesus' side. But we have to focus with ferocious concentration on this type of love. Today, St. Paul tells us, "Owe nothing to no one except to love one another." Not only is this a statement against amassing financial debt, words that are very important today in a culture that doesn't save but charges way beyond our means on credit cards or borrows way beyond our means as a national government, but it's a reminder to us that we do have a debt to love one another. Loving one another is not a good suggestion by Jesus. It's not even merely a command. It's a debt we owe. It's a real duty, something that others deserve from us in justice. This might seem strange at first to think that we owe everyone a debt of love. But when we take seriously Jesus' words, that whatever we do to the least of our brothers and sisters, we do to him, or what we fail to do to the least of our brothers and sisters, we fail to do to him, then it becomes clear that because we owe him everything, so do we owe our neighbor. Notice that Jesus didn't say, "Love me as I have loved you," but "Love one another as I have loved you." When he asked Simon, son of John, at the end of the gospel, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And three times he said, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love me." He didn't say, "I love you, you love me, we're one happy family." No, he didn't say that. He said, "Feed my sheep, feed my lambs, tend my sheep." The way we would love Jesus would be the way that we would love all those he has put in our way. St. Carol Wojtyla, the future Pope John Paul II, wrote in his beautiful book, Love and Responsibility, that the other is someone before whom the only worthy response is love. Not just courtesy, not just kindness, but self-sacrificial love. That's who the other is, because the other is the image of God. So how do we pay this debt? First, by keeping the commandment. Today, St. Paul lists the second tablet of the Decalogue, focused on love of neighbor, reminding us that one who loves another has fulfilled the law. Jesus said something similar in St. Matthew's Gospel when he reminded us that all the law and the prophets, all 613 commandments in the Old Covenant, including the 10 most famous commandments, hinges on the love of God with all our mind, heart, soul, and strength, and the love of our neighbor as ourselves. We can't really love our parents if we're dishonoring them. We can't love someone else if we're hating them, or putting them to death, or using them for our own sexual kicks, or ripping them off, or deceiving them, or are envious about the blessings they've received. We begin to pay the debt of love when we reverence our parents despite their shortcomings, when we risk our lives to save others, when we sacrifice the desires of the flesh out of love for other souls, when we give others what we have rather than steal from them, when we tell them the truth, even if we might suffer as a result, when we rejoice at what God has given them, rather than seek it selfishly for ourselves. But even though keeping the commandments with love is the fulfillment of the law, we're called to go beyond the minimum of the law to the full standard of the love of Christ. You remember in the Sermon on the Mount, Christ told us, it's not enough to just love others who love us. Even the pagans do that much. We're called to love even our enemies, to pray for those who persecute us, to do good to those who do evil to us. That's his standard. And he never calls us to something that he's not going to give us the grace to do. But we owe a debt, even to our enemies, to love them, just like Christ paid that debt for all of us who through our sins were crucifying him on Calvary. Christ's standard of love involves willing the good even of our enemies, unselfish self-sacrifice, patience, kindness, humility, perseverance, sincerity, devotion, fervor, fidelity, and affection. As we see in the list of attributes for love, St. Paul gives us in Romans 12 and 1 Corinthians 13. God pours his love into our hearts precisely so that, filled with that gift, we can love others not just with our finite love, but with his infinite love. I'd like to bring up 3 points so that we can become more concrete in fulfilling this duty of love we owe to others. The first is, how often do we say the words, I love you, to people? I'm not just talking about our spouse or our children or our parents, although we should regularly be expressing our love with words to them as well as with our deeds. I'm talking about our neighbors. Jesus said to us, just as the Father loves me, I love you. He wasn't afraid to say that he loved us. His whole life was an expression of his love for us. We're living in a world in which one of the greatest spiritual diseases is people don't think that they're lovable. Many times they haven't learned it in the family. Our culture doesn't do it. It just uses people and spits them out wounded. And we Christians have been sent into the world as missionaries of this love, but we're never going to fulfill it unless we have the courage to say to people, I love you. Just as Jesus loves me, I love you. To say it to our friends, to say it to our fellow parishioners, to say it to our co-workers, to say it with others with whom we normally interact. If we're too uncomfortable ever to say the words, I love you, to these groups of people, the reason may be precisely because we don't love them with affection from the heart as Christ calls us to. Just as Jesus loves us and says it, so he wants us to love others. This is very real. I don't often give personal witnesses, but I was already ordained a priest. I'd already preached many homilies on love. But it was December 30th, 1999, at the top of the Via della Conciliazione in Rome, that I was talking to a religious sister friend of mine who was in one of my classes over there. She was talking about a conversation she had just had after Christmas with one of our professors. And he said something about me, and she just kind of blurted out at the top of the Via della Conciliazione, that's why I told him, that's why I love Father Roger so much. And I'm never at a loss for words. But I was totally catatonic. I couldn't say a thing. I was wondering why. I was like Arthur Fonzarelli saying the word sorry in those Happy Days episodes of yesteryear. I went back to the chapel at the North American College and I said, What's that all about? I'd realized that I just couldn't say, even to this totally lovable sister with chaste words, I love you too. I couldn't do it. I was handicapped. Even though my vocation, like St. Therese Lisieux's vocation, was to be love in the heart of the church, I couldn't say it. 6 weeks later, another sister from the Nashville Dominican came up to me and said the exact same thing. Father Roger, I love you. Thank you for all you're doing. 9 days later, a sister who's a Carmelite in California said the same thing. It was almost as if Jesus was trying to tell me, if I said it once, I've said it multiple times, and I'm saying it now through my brides. Roger, you're lovable. We need to hear it. And we need to say it. Second, do we love with sacrifice? Do we pay this debt of love through our deeds? No one has any greater love, Jesus tells us, than to lay down his life for his friends. In most cases, we won't have to make a supreme sacrifice for others. But are we willing, at least in little things, to die to ourselves and our own self-interest for others? Are we willing to make serious sacrifices of our financial savings and of our time, especially when others need it? Do I sacrifice for the person next to me? Do I recognize that this type of self-giving is something I owe and that the other is worthy of it? Do I count the cost of loving and wait for a quid pro quo? Or do I imitate Jesus in giving, even if it should be unrequited? Jesus is calling us to pay our debt to another, even if the other won't pay that same debt to us. And then third, in this month of November, we need to ponder a lot the fact that we will die. The Imitation of Christ, that great spiritual classic, has that point. Wake up every morning and live that day as if it will be the last day God gives you. Because once we do, we put things into focus. If today's the last day God gives us, we're probably not going to spend the whole day watching football. We'll probably have greater courage to tell the people we haven't told in a long time that we love them. Or if we need to ask somebody's forgiveness, we're probably going to act. And if we need to go to confession, we're probably going to find a confessor. And if we're preparing to be in God's presence forever, we might make time to come and spend some extra time in prayer. It focuses us for this type of self-giving. Cardinal Justin Regali, back in 2011, the former Archbishop of Philadelphia, gave an incredible meditation on preparation for death, in which he said, every day we should be meditating on two phrases of the Lord. First phrase is, no one takes my life from me, I freely lay it down. In other words, we're not going to be a victim. With total freedom, we're going to lay our life down for others. And when we live each day that way, it changes how we interact and makes us much more courageous and self-giving. Second phrase, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. That we're entrusting our entire life to God. And if we do that every day, then when the final day comes, we'll just be reiterating what was our entire life. We entrust ourselves to our Father with courage as we try to love with the love of the Father. I'd like to illustrate these points with a story. Today, November 4th, is the feast of St. Charles Borromeo, the great reforming Archbishop of Milan in the 1500s, who has so much to teach us for the reform of the Church in 2018. In 1571, the plague came to Milan. People were dying by the tens of thousands. So many others, because all the businessmen had fled from the city, were starving. Borromeo sold all he had, both in the archbishop's residence as well as his personal inheritance. He was a descendant of the Medici family. He sold it all to care for the poor. He sought to engage the priests of the Archdiocese of Milan, but so many of them were afraid. They were afraid of catching the plague and dying. They were stingy with regard to the debt of love they owed to others. St. Charles spoke to them with words that each of us can apply in general to every situation of our life, especially with regard to how many people are languishing in a type of spiritual plague that is separating them from God. Borromeo said, how can those of us upon whom mercy has been given and liberally poured out be so tightly limited with our own mercy and measure it out in accord with temporal and external necessities? The same Son of God who, for the sake of the salvation of all men, including his enemies and the impious, was fixed to the cross and died in greatest shame and the bitterest torment, invites us to go forward into the danger of a quiet and glorious death for our brothers. He to whom we owe as much repayment as we could not obtain by dying 1,000 times without end, doesn't even request this pathetic life of ours. He only requests that we put that life at risk. We see many go through these dangers without escaping death. Moreover, we see many who are free from fear but still die. But if we do not escape death, this will not be death. Rather, it will be the quicker attainment of blessed glory, which is true life. Our fathers, incited by God's Spirit, did the same in similar circumstances. They taught that this is what should be done. They extolled a work of this kind because it is the greatest power to motivate our soul to confirm that they are the stuff of martyrs. It is indeed a desirable time now, when without the cruelty of a tyrant, without the rack, without fire, without beasts, in the complete absence of harsh tortures that are usually the most frightful to human weakness, we can obtain the crown of martyrdom. He was calling the priests of his age, and with them all of us today, to obtain the crown of martyrs, not necessarily by shedding our blood, but by pouring out our sweat, in pouring out the contents of our heart in a witness of love for those who are in need. It's through sacrificing ourselves for others in the present, even risking our lives to do so, that we grow in the love that makes us martyrs and saints. The Lord this November wants to fortify us against all our fears and help us to love in such a way that in the twilight of life, as he judges us on love, he will say, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Inherit the kingdom of love prepared for you since the foundation of the world." And to strengthen us against our fears and to fortify us for this type of love, he gives us his own love in flesh and says, "Do this in my memory."